Hello and welcome to JOSPT Insights, the podcast that aims to help you translate quality research to quality practice. I'm Claire Ardern, the Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Orthopaedic and Sports Physical Therapy. It's great to have you listening today. Are you looking for some guidance on what to test and how to think about using the results of clinical tests when you're designing, implementing, and progressing a rehabilitation program? Well, you're in the right place, because today Dr. Eric Hamrin-Sinorski joins me to share how he blends his research training with his clinical skill set to best help athletes and active people with ACL injury. And the beauty of today's chat is that the principles apply to any program you might think about designing. So even if you don't see many people with ACL injuries, you will definitely find value in today's episode. Dr. Hamrin-Sinorski is an associate professor at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden and a specialist sports physiotherapist in practice in Gothenburg. At the clinic and in research, Eric focuses on sports-related injuries to the lower extremities, and most of his work has been on understanding the interplay of orthopaedic and physical therapy data to make better rehabilitation decisions. Dr. Eric Hamrin-Sinorski, welcome to JOSPT Insights.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here and try to contribute with some good discussion.
You can definitely contribute because you are a clinician scientist in the absolute truest sense of the phrase. You're in the clinic, you're working with athletes of all ages and all levels each week, and you are collecting loads of data from those clinical encounters. And I'm looking forward to hearing about how you use those data to help you help the patients and athletes you're working with. I want to start by asking you, what are the metrics that you pay most attention to during your ACL rehabilitation programs?
Just as you said, I am a clinician researcher, so I have a very good setup where I do research and I have clinic. And what we've been very happy with in Gothenburg is that we started a local project, which we call Project ACL, which is just for any patient within the area or Sweden that could come to the clinic, and they could come there and they get to run through a series of structured tests of muscle function and patient-reported outcomes. And this is regardless of whether you had surgery, if you don't have surgery, regardless where you're doing your rehabilitation. And the results are shared, the clinicians and the surgeon and the patient, which has really been a good thing to create compliance. It has good clinical information, but maybe a bit much research. But there's also things that we look at in clinic, of course, which also matters, because it's really about covering the patient's injury, and what are the goals and expectations that we're looking for.
It's interesting that you talk about being in this very special environment and Project ACL having a very particular setup and being privileged to have the data. And I would argue that the data you're collecting and the data that are going into the Project ACL database are actually really clinically relevant data points, and they are metrics that most people who are working often with people with ACL injuries, they're probably collecting. It's maybe a clinical practice environment at a scale. So tell us a bit about what are those key metrics, or what are the measurements that go into Project ACL? Because I'll bet that people listening to us are going to think, oh, I'm measuring that. It's a nice reminder that even in our clinical, in our maybe individual clinical contexts, we do have almost a mini research project. And that's the beauty of, and underscores why it's so important to measure stuff in the clinic. As our friend and colleague, Professor Lynn Snyder-Mackler says, if you're not measuring, you're guessing it.
That's a brilliant quote. I really like that quote. So what we do is we have certain follow-ups. They're after injury or after reconstruction. We do 10 weeks after injury reconstructions. We do 4 months. We do 8 months. We do 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, and then every fifth year. And what we collect is isokinetic strength tests, quadriceps hamstring strength. We start that at 10 weeks. Then at 4 months or forward, we start doing hop tests. And the three hop tests that we use is the hop for distance, the vertical jump, and the 30-second side hop test, which are simple, good tests. And they reflect the patient's function in a good way. Or for the test battery, we also have some patient-reported outcomes. So we use the COOS, We used the ACL-RSI. We used the knee self-efficacy scale and a few others. We used the tegner activity scale to measure some kind of return to sports aspect. But the key to the project success and for clinicians is that we provide the patients and the clinicians with a test protocol where you can see how well did you do at 10 weeks? How well did you do at 4 months? How well did you do at 8 months? So you can follow the progression through rehab and help guide the patient to make better or smarter decisions along the way.
That's so important. And I think many of the folks listening to us today will know from talking with athletes and patients that people want to know where, most people want a sense of, where am I up to? Am I doing as you're expecting? How am I doing compared to other people? A lot of athletes are very competitive, so they want to know, how am I doing compared to other teammates? So this is the beauty of having that bigger data set, isn't it? Where you can use some summary data and provide people bit of a guide about, you know, how are they doing? How is their physical function? How are their questionnaires? How are their scores doing compared to what we would typically expect? How do people respond to getting that information?
Well, our perception of it is that they like it a lot. People like to know that your injured limb is 20% weaker than your healthy limb. And compared to statistics of all the patients in this project, I'm 10% behind at this follow-up. So, okay, I need to get my act together. Or, well, you can use it as some kind of, there are all the factors you as a clinician can use it. So given that you also had this meniscal injury and had suture repair of your meniscal injury, it's not strange that you're a little bit behind. But no worries, if we just give it enough time, you'll make it back.
And I love that you raise the support for clinicians, particularly if you're someone who is maybe not seeing so many athletes or patients with an ACL injury. You might see one or two or three per year. Then having that reassurance of knowing a bit of benchmarking, is this person where I would expect? Or if it's a more unusual injury that you're much less likely to see, again, having that sense of, okay, this is roughly what I would expect compared to a much larger data set, I think is a really helpful way of using information. We talk a lot about using information to help us support athletes to make clinical to make decisions for them. It's also helpful for clinicians making clinical decisions and supporting your clinical reasoning. I want to talk a little bit about how you interpret the information that's in the database, Eric. Before we get there, how many data points are in this database, or how many athletes roughly are in this database?
We have I don't know the exact number, we have over 4,000 patients. So covering patients from, I think, around 8 years to 70 years old. So it's a good data. It gives you a lot of details.
That's fantastic. And we will link to the resources. We'll link to the website and other resources as we go through the podcast, and people can find those links in the show notes. Let's come back to interpreting some of the data from this wonderful database. I would really like to talk about the HOP and the strength measures, because I think people will remember or recognize there's heaps of discussion around how do you make sense of these numbers, particularly hopping and strength testing, where you're testing both limbs. And some people would argue that it's really not good to compare to the uninjured side. That's a bit of a challenge in real life clinical practice, because often we don't have pre-injury measures. If you're working in a team environment, you may have the luxury, I guess, of having pre-injury measures. In the clinic, we typically don't. So how do you make sense of the data that you're getting, particularly with the hopping and the strength test results?
We have pushed for a long while in the project, and I still do in clinic. I'll confess to that looking for this 90% LSI landmark, but also thinking it's a 10% deviation from being symmetrical. So we're not trying to go above 110 for logical reasons. It's something that we push. I know there's a discussion out there that it's not good. I think it is good, but you have to consider, what is it good for? It won't explain everything. It may not explain why certain patients go on to have a second injury, but we know there is some correlation with being more symmetrical, appears to correlate quite well with the recovery of patient-reported outcomes and moving more towards normal. And looking 1 year down the line, well, 20 to 30 patients have recovered within that deviation from 10% from being symmetrical. So there's quite some work we can still do in trying to push our patients, motivate our patients to do better. And I think given that, it is a good, it's good to compare to the uninjured side, but it won't tell us the whole story. Well, there are some different options out there. There are, as you said, if you're lucky enough, you have pre-injury data. You may also have, if you don't have that, you may have pre-operative data, which may be more relevant because we typically see some sort of decrease in also the healthy limb after reconstruction. You can also think of maybe we should put, and we've given this some effort recently, that maybe we should put some effort into looking how well is your strength or your hop performance compared to your body weight. So sort of relative to your body weight, is it enough compared to what you're doing? The thing which I really want to highlight, where I think we will find the most in the recent coming years, is that we're probably going to move away from just looking at point predictions, looking at what doesn't matter if you had recovered the 90% or 100%, and trying to estimate everything that will happen to you during a certain amount of time after that point, even if it's a half a year or a year or 2 years or whatever we're talking about. Series of testing and trying to understand things, how they line up over time. It's like being a coach for an athlete. You don't predict their performance based on one workout they do at one point because there's so many things that can affect what you're doing that day.
There's a few threads there that are really interesting, and I want to pick up on a couple of them. One is you mentioned this idea of trajectories, and I really like the analogy of if you're a coach, you're not evaluating the athlete's overall performance based on one session. And I think that will really resonate with clinicians for exactly the reason that you described. So having the capacity to look over time and look at the trajectory over time is really helpful. And I think, again, it's this sense of not relying on one individual piece of information that is why some of these data sets like your database, and there are other databases we know out there, people doing similar kinds of work and making these data available, is giving us as clinicians different pieces of information, different pieces of the puzzle to put together. So there are, I think it's reassuring to know that there are a lot of different options out there. So you're not solely relying on comparing to the opposite side all the time. Let's talk a little bit about the risk and the reward of supporting athletes when they're returning to pivoting sports. I'm going to focus on the high-risk pivoting and cutting sports like football, soccer, American football, basketball, and ACL rehabilitation. What would you advise clinicians and athletes when they're thinking about this balance, this dance, if you like, Eric? How risky is it to return to those pivoting sports? And what are you really looking for when you're supporting that return to sport phase?
We have a few scenarios here which are difficult. We see that a lot of athletes, they don't make it back at all for some reason.
And when you say a lot, what proportion is that, Eric?
Well, it depends who you ask, isn't it? If we read your systematic review, it's around 50%. If we ask the athlete, we followed up all the patients who underwent surgery who were pediatric or adolescents in Sweden, who were in the national database for ACL. And we asked them a bunch of questions about returning to sport and how well they did and so on. And the proportions from athletes who were able to return and consider themselves as being able to perform at the same level as before their injury was 10%.
Wow.
So that's not that many.
No, 1 in 10. That's pretty low.
Yeah. So they're back in sports, but they're not where they want to be or believe they should be. And we have a lot of patients who make it back, but they decide to quit, maybe because they're not feeling that well or performing that well. There's also a lot of re-injuries, which we see in tons of data, especially in pediatric and adolescents. We really need to reconsider what we're doing and what we're trying to frame here. And I think for the athletes who are going back to risk sports, this is where it becomes challenging for clinicians, because we really need to think of all the risk factors that a patient may have. Is it bony morphology? Is it the type of sport? Is it the position they're playing? Do they have persistent laxity? Do they have something else driving their risk? And then nobody can tell you, or today we don't have an instrument good enough saying that your risk will be 50%. But if we did, what is the risk that you as a clinician would be comfortable with? That's a difficult question. It's a totally different question asking the patient what risk they would be comfortable with. That's where sort of the discussion has to start. You have to put all those risk factors on the table. And somewhere we listen to the patient, we try to help them reach their goal, though by providing relevant and direct information and recommendations. But if they want to return, although I may not consider it, my approach is, okay, we're going to have to put up some goals depending on what you're doing and what you should be able to do within your sport, what is relevant for that sport. And I will say, you're not good enough and you have to prove me wrong. And I think that's a way of giving the athlete a bit more time, testing the athlete in a relevant way, and sort of guiding them closer to their sport and what they're doing. We have to think about what type of re-injuries are we talking about. I'm pretty sure rehab has an important role in helping non-contact ACL injuries. Certain type of contact injuries, I'm not sure they can be prevented. Research should do better in trying to be more specific. What type of re-injuries are we trying to prevent? And have we actually looked at that in our data? Provide better recommendations for clinicians and patients.
Definitely. And I know Dr. Hege Grindem and her colleagues in Oslo have done a lot of work at trying to look beyond the ACL rupture and thinking that there are a whole lot of other possible injuries or re-injuries or trauma that can occur to that knee joint after you go back to sport, whether that's another meniscus tear, whether it's another chondral injury or an ACL tear, that there is, as you say, that there's a lot, there are plenty of other structures that are really important in the knee beyond the ACL. The ACL is an important structure, and then there are others on top of that to pay attention to. And I think you're right that we don't have nearly as good a sense of the overall trauma or re-injuries to the knee and the structures of the knee itself as we do. We've got a reasonably good overview of re-injuries to the ACL. And we're primarily talking about re-injuries to that same knee. There's injuries to the opposite knee, as you know. So there is, I think, a lot of work still to do to help us understand what goes on, what's going on after someone gets back to these much more higher risk scenarios. So maybe someone who's listening today and thinking about a PhD in ACL, in the ACL field, there's some ideas for you. Let's start to wrap up our chat here, Eric, and I cannot let you go without talking a little bit about how your approach to rehabilitation differs depending on the person. How do you tailor a rehabilitation program and your return to sport planning, your planning for secondary and tertiary injury prevention, depending on the personality, the characteristics, how the athlete themselves is responding? And I'm sure that people will recognize there are some kind of stereotypes of patients out there. There's the person who speeds through rehab, doesn't seem to really have any issues, gets through in 3 months, and you think, oh my goodness, please, I'm really worried about you getting back too quickly. They can't get back to the football pitch or the soccer pitch fast enough, versus the person who is really apprehensive and you feel like you're constantly reassuring and trying to support this person to see that they are making progress. How do you make a rehabilitation program, your return to sport planning, truly athlete-focused and athlete-centered?
I think an important thing when we speak about this is saying that, well, what we see in the literature now, the evidence is probably still pretty weak, but we're seeing that the athletes that are doing pretty good, they feel confident, they feel strong, they are strong compared to their body weight and so on, they may be the patients who are at greater risk of having a second ACL injury quite early because things are feeling good and they're probably very eager to go back. We as clinicians, we're proven wrong when we're trying to say that you're not good enough and they're meeting all these landmarks and we're letting them back a bit too early. What I see now and clinic is that when I see patients doing really good and I see I see these patients meeting the quite simple landmarks of, say, using LSI 90 at 4 months for strength tests and hop tests. I start feeling that, okay, these tests may not be relevant for this patient. They're too good and this is too early. So I try to raise the bar a little bit. And one way of trying to do this is trying to use patient report outcomes, trying to measure their personality traits or psychology or what we may want to call it, and a little bit see how things line up. Because sometimes they're doing really good muscle function-wise, they're doing really good at patient report outcomes, or it could be the other way around, they're doing bad at both, or there's a mismatch there. And something tells me the mismatch may be a bit more worrying. The patient feels really confident, but their muscle function is not there, or their muscle function is there, but they're not feeling that good. And this is where we have to invest more of our time, I feel, as clinicians, trying to understand. But then if we try to seek support in the literature of what to do, there's not much out there that intervention-wise will make us more secure or make smarter decisions yet. I hope there will be quite soon. Let's pick the situation where the patient is doing really good. That's where we need to be more gradual with the return to sports phase, where we make sure they have some kind of on-field rehabilitation. This is very difficult in the clinical scenario because there's usually not time or economy to have this done unless you're in a professional setting, but we really should consider it. And given some of the data out there showing that, well, time to return to sports is important, maybe just making sure those hours of training and making good decisions in training plays an important role in preparing the athlete for what they're going to. So just taking things a bit more slow or finding new tests. We love new tests. In our little, now it's not that little, our project, but our project, we're trying new tests. We're trying change of direction tests. We introduced the Nordborg test, so an eccentric hamstring test a few years ago, where you find it does not correlate that well with the isokinetic testing, the seated isokinetic testing. So we're trying to find other things which maybe helps us find pieces of the puzzle which may protect the athlete better from going back too early and having a big setback in terms of a second injury or failing to prepare for what they're doing.
And this is why we need people like you who are truly clinician researchers, clinician scientists, because you're taking those questions that come up all of the time, those clinical challenges, those knotty issues that you see in the clinic, and translating them into research questions and into projects with a design that is scientifically set up to give us information that we can trust when we go back into the clinic.
I just want to add one thing, to be fair, which I think is very in important. Because when I spoke about this, it sounds like I have a bias of time. But giving things more time, things will work out. And I sort of do. But given that some of the things that I said, that if the patient has too many risk factors, say there is persistent laxity, the patient's hypermobile, they have concomitant injuries, they're not meeting landmarks, they may be young, they may be playing soccer, maybe one ACL injury is enough. And that patient would be better off actually being recommended. You should probably quit soccer. We could find something else for you to consider and play. And we have to have the courage within ourselves to push those decisions. And I hope to see research transition a little bit more towards this direction as well, that given a certain amount of risk factors, the risk may actually be too high for us to recommend. And our recommendation should be you should consider a different sport.
I'm so glad that you get us to that place, Eric, because that's, I think, one of the biggest challenges in clinical practice is, when is it time to stop? And how do you broach that conversation in a way that respects the athlete's agency and capacity to make a decision that is right for them, versus sharing information in a way that's honest and that conveys just how serious the long-term ramifications might end up. And this is the constant challenge. We are not fortune tellers. We can't tell you with certainty what's going to happen in the future and whether you're in your future is severe knee osteoarthritis that's going to really debilitate you for the rest of your life. Or maybe you're completely fine. It's really challenging. So I'm really glad that you remind us of that conversation or conversations, I think. It's not a one-off discussion that you have with athletes. It's a much more ongoing discussion, information sharing. So Dr. Eric Kamrin-Sanorski, thanks so much for bringing your clinical hat and your research hat to JOSPT Insights today. It's been wonderful hearing from you about how you reconcile the information coming from both of these places and use that information to really boost the work that you're doing in both the research environment and the clinical environment. We're all very thankful for people like you helping us support athletes.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of JOSPT Insights. For more discussion of the issues in musculoskeletal rehabilitation that are relevant to your practice, subscribe to JOSPT Insights on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google, or your favourite podcast app. If you like JOSPT Insights, help others find us. Tell your friends and colleagues and rate and review us. To keep up to date with all the latest JOSPT content, be sure to follow us on Twitter, we're at JOSPT, and Facebook, we're JOSPT Official. Talk with you next time.